Steve Adams from the Radio Attic is joining us here this afternoon. And Steve owns, operates, administers the Radio Attic, which is a place for all things antique radio. And he does a fine job of it as well. How are things down your way? What's new on the attic, Steve?
Oh, thank you for your kind words, first of all, Paul. What's new on the attic is they've got is the sales. It's been a good year for radio sales. It's been an active year for new radios on the site. We've got a record number of radios on the site. I think there's a lot of interest in the antique radio hobby, not only evidenced at the Radio Attic, but in other places as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about that as far as, you know, your opinion on state of the hobby, where you talk to so many folks who do restorations and hunt down old sets and certainly put them up on the attic and try to sell them. You know, they have their own channels. They bring them to club meets and whatnot. It seems to be, even though it's a graying hobby, as they say, there seems to be a little bit of a movement among some of the younger folks to kind of keep the ball rolling, as a lot of the old-timers at the different clubs are slowing down and they can't organize them. There are some people who are stepping up, so I guess that's good news for anybody who's interested in maybe getting into the hobby now.
Well, I will say that a lot of the local clubs are actively trying to get young people into the hobby. A couple of years ago, for example, I went to a Christmas dinner for the Alabama Historical Radio Society and met a young man there who is, I forget, 15, I think, very excited about the hobby, very interested in the hobby. And the online forums are the same way that, I've looked at, too. They will pick up radios as a hobby that kind of like loners in their high schools and their grammar schools, because not a lot of kids are doing this. But as you say, the hobby is graying, but people are taking an active role in trying to recruit younger people back into this.
Well, I just recently read an article in Antique Radio Classified about the sort of they're trying to regenerate the California Historical Radio Society, and I know you're familiar with a couple of the guys out there because they have a big presence selling radios on the attic right now. They're selling, I guess it was one fellow's collection, which was a huge collection, and they're selling their sets from that collection that were bequeathed to the society to raise some funds for their program. They're trying to breathe a little fresh air back into the California Society, and they're actually, I mentioned this earlier in the show, restoring a vintage radio station, you know, not just restoring a vintage radio,
right,
but they're restoring a station, turning it into a museum, and they're going to do a circa 1950s broadcasting, you know, DJ section of it, and then they're going to have a radio museum. They have some really nice sets that people have donated to, so it's something different.
That's a very ambitious undertaking. It looks like it's going well, though. They've got a lot of dedicated folks in that club that are really trying to get that rolling.
Well, I've seen some of the photos, and it's pretty startling because it's a decrepit old-looking Bay Area building, and I'm not sure exactly where it is, but it's covered with graffiti, and it's, you know, it's falling apart, and they were taking photos, different stages as far as getting it cleaned up, getting the graffiti off, getting the paint on, getting in the studios. They got people donating time. They're laying floors and doing wallboard. And one of the guys, they have this really neat door on one of the studios, sort of it almost very Art Deco. It's sort of an imprint of a star with a, you know, circle. You can look into the studio. And it's really neat stuff, but it also talks a little bit more about, it's not just, you know, a radio hobby as far as I have these 15 sets in my basement. It represents a little bit of an industry, of a, you know, a time frame, and, you know, reflects on the popular culture to a great extent as well. So good luck to them out there. I hope they keep things keeping on and they get some more interest in their society. As far as the attic itself, Steve, where we've got some folks, hopefully, who, you know, may be new to the collecting hobby, why don't you give us a little overview of what the Radio Attic is and what it can do for somebody and what's going on as far as the different segments in the attic, because there's certainly the selling of radios that exists there, but there's a whole lot more to it as well.
Well, okay, thank you. The Radio Attic started out as RadioGallery.com back in 1996. There are two radio clubs that I knew of in Alabama at the time. One of them was not interested at the time in swap meets. The other one did, but it was a very small swap meet. And as a new collector, I was looking for places to buy radios. I think eBay was just starting up then with radios, and there are other online news groups trying to sell radios also. But if the selling was predominantly anonymous, you didn't really know what you were getting. Photographs were not predominant, and I wanted to find some place that would be a good place for collectors to go on the internet, which was a fairly new, at least to me, thing at that time. And RadioGallery.com came out. It closed a couple of years after that, and in 1999 I reopened as the Radio Attic, which was a slightly different concept as far as my administration and my financial end of it went. And it has evolved over the past almost 12 years now as a hopefully a premier venue for buying and selling radios. I try to pre-interview sellers before they come on the attic to make sure that they have my philosophy of radio collecting and dealings with the buyers in particular. And I've got about 60 active people there right now, 60 active sellers. Some are very prolific. I will say that they do this primarily as an income generating tool, which is fine for them. And right now there are, oh gosh, I think 1,300 radios and other radio-related items for sale there right now, all with photographs. It's not an auction. It's low pressure. Every seller has a name and a contact way. You directly communicate with the seller at your leisure before you buy something. Photographs are there for the seller chooses to put them there. And it's a friendly place to buy radios, I think. And one that I'm trying to continue to keep in that friendly vein. I call myself friendly webmaster just to kind of set the tone.
Well, you know, I just have to say, you know, my own experience with picking up a few things from the attic, and in general in this hobby, but you know, especially when I've chatted with a couple of the old timers, you know, with swap emails, folks I've met on the attic, universally seem to be real gentlemen about the whole scene. They're interested in educating you. No question is a stupid question, you know, as the teacher in class used to say. They're glad to show you different angles. I've had people send me, oh, you didn't see enough in the photos. Well, they'll send you to your own email. You know, some of them will. They'll send you a couple extra photos. You wanted to see something on the chassis or you wanted to see a different look on it. And again, you know, you contrast this to this anonymous buying that people can do, especially. You know, eBay is a crazy place to be sometimes for selling and buying anything, but you never know these people. You don't know if they're collectors. You don't know if somebody pulled it off of a junk heap. And generally speaking, I'd have to say, as things are described, I've seen people go out of their way on the attic to say, oh, yeah, and by the way, it's got a couple of real bad scratches, you know, on the top. But, you know, you could probably do this and do that to rectify them, or it doesn't detract too much from its ability to be displayed, and they're very straightforward. You know, there's rust on the chassis, so it's a nice place to go. The people are informative. They're generally willing to inform you, instruct you, offer you something else if it didn't turn out. I've had instances where I was offered something else as a substitute, which turned out to be probably better than what I wanted in the first place.
I think the communication is very valuable, and I've told. I don't coach my sellers, but I try to talk to them about sellers' terms and how to communicate with prospective buyers, what the buyers are looking for. You know, I've said many times, in fact, it's stated on the website on one of the pages that my favorite way to buy roll radios is a swap meet, because sure. You're right there with the seller. You can look them in the eye and pick up the radio and look inside. But if you can't get to a swap meet, is always the Radio Attic.
I know. And you know, the other thing is, we talked a little bit earlier, I went over my rule number one, which is rule number one is when you find that old setup in somebody's attic that's been sitting there for 75 years, 70 years, don't plug it in. Just don't. You know, have it checked out, have it looked at by somebody who's competent. You could hurt yourself, you could hurt your house, you could hurt the radio, you know, if you put in, you know, too much AC and the components have degraded to the point where the current goes at too high a level to places it shouldn't be, and you know, you might take a set that could be worked on and brought back to life and just blow the thing out beyond what you'd ever want to spend to repair it. But you have a whole section on there for folks who are resources for repair, from cabinets to electronics as well, which maybe you could talk a little bit about that as far as giving people an idea where these guys are and how easy it is to get a hold of them if you wanted to have something brought back to life.
I've tried to put two good links pages on the website. One's just an overall links page, and the other one's dedicated to restoration and repair resources to people who do this for money, who fix radios for money. I wish it got more attention from the resources than it does. They're popular pages. It's always a chore to get people to volunteer to put their name out in front of the public for this. But there are people that do this, and a lot of them do a very good job. And I've tried to make that available on the site as well. You know, you were talking about communication before, and my thought on communication and working with prospective buyers and other people in the hobby is we are such a small community, we do not need to be making other people angry. We do not need to be selling stuff that isn't as advertised. We do not need to be selling junk with rodents and urine inside. We don't need to be doing that. We want to present not only ourselves, but these radios, which are a wonderful, historic treasure of not only United States history, but history of companies around the world, countries around the world. That's something that really needs to be preserved. So many times, I'll get emails about people, I've got this really cool chassis that I want to make into a bar. Oh, well, okay. And I don't encourage that at all. I know sometimes it's too late.
Yeah.
But not just the furniture aspect or the construction aspect of an old radio, but the technology that went into it, the changing technologies, the history of who worked this radio back when it was new or in its active history. That's just something that doesn't need to be thrown in the trash. It doesn't need to be ripped out of its housing and discarded, because there's you never know.
Well, horrors of horrors. You know, you hear these stories when somebody would actually take the chassis out and then put in a little transistor radio in the cabinet.
If all else fails, I mean, if you drop it in the disposal or something like that and it's destroyed, you don't have a lot of options other than finding another chassis. But the historical aspect, I just put a radio in the archives a couple of weeks ago. That family history of the radio was that it could have been used by a Dutch family during World War II as part of the Dutch resistance, as far as to get signals for resisting the Germans in the country, and that's just incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's an amazing that you could probably do a show and just talk about radio in World War II. As a whole, you could go on. You could probably do a series of programs on it.
Oh,
but,
sure.
Occasionally, you will see, and I know there are some people who, for personal reasons, and many of them because they were involved in the war. The German manufacturers made these radios that were crummy radios. They were people's radios. They were low strength. They couldn't pull in a good signal. They basically were radios that you would buy at a cheap price if you lived in Germany, and you were really limiting yourself to listening to whatever the propaganda was that Hitler and Goebbels wanted to put out, and you were not going to pick up the BBC, and you were not going to pick up any other foreign broadcasts, and they knew that. But yet, there were people who had sets that they had bought that were good sets, and they couldn't route them all out, though. I know people would, even listen to see if somebody was listening to the BBC. They'd listen on their neighbors and rat them out to the authorities. But how did news get into Germany outside of the command structure, outside of that propaganda nozzle that they were pumping into people's heads? And basically it was if somebody could slip in and slip out somehow, or you had contact with your relatives through somebody, or, the number one source was shortwave radio.
Correct.
And in many cases, the Allies used it extensively to translate, send in messages. It's a fascinating thing, but it's just another sort of angle on the whole thing. Just to back up a little bit to the resources page we were talking about, one of the things I get a kick out of is there's a whole section on there. People send in photos of their workbenches, the guys who, and I don't fix radios myself. I know enough to be dangerous. And I know
I don't either. And if
Steve is in the same boat.
I don't know how to fix radios.
But there are an awful lot of people who do. And one of the things I find wonderfully ironic is, you scroll through a lot of these workbenches. The people are very proud of their setups that they have to do repair work. And they have a lot of extremely high-tech, solid-state equipment that they are applying to this technology that existed in the 30s and the 40s to troubleshoot problems, to find, troubleshoot signal issues, electrical issues. And they're devoting all of this stuff, this very high-tech, very new-age electronics, to trying to preserve this stuff that goes back to the 20s and 30s and the 40s. And I get kind of a kick out of that. And I also like it. It personalizes some of these guys who sell as well as restore. You get to see, you know, the time and the effort and the labor that they've taken in putting together their workbench to try to do a good restoration or do a good repair job prior to having a radio put up for sale on the attic. And I like that. There's a couple of guys. There's a guy from, I don't know if it was Venezuela or Brazil, but there are some folks from outside the U.S. who have even listed on there too.
And yeah, there are several from outside the country, and a lot of them have sent photos for the archives as well.
Well, the archives itself exists for, I talked a little bit about this earlier when we were opening up the show. If you're trying to identify, say you saw something when you were a kid and you said, gee, you know, we used to listen to the New York Yankees games on this when I was down at my, you know, grandfather's house down in Long Island, and I knew a radio, it looked like this, I think it was a General Electric, but I'm not sure. Well, on the Radio Attic, there's a whole section of archives where folks submitted photographs of radios in their collection or that they've put up for sale. And you can scroll through by manufacturer if you would like. Here's General Electric's, and you can look and look and like, yeah, well, yeah, hey, that looks like the one, you know. And you might just very well find, you know, even to the make and model and year of manufacture, the information on that set that you've been trying to pin down that's been floating around in the back of your head that you would like to have for yourself now.
The archives was suggested to me by a collector here in Alabama years ago, and I initially said, well, that's going to be a lot of work, and I did it anyway, and I was right. but I won't go. Let me just say that learning how to use the database for the website and how to code access into the database has made it a lot easier. It is primarily an identification resource. I try to have unique identified radios, and there's about 330 some odd unknown radios there as well. But I have a separate photo. If it has the same model, I have additional photos of a radio that has, say, a different dial coloring or different paint scheme on the cabinet, things like that. But right now there are over 10,100 unique identified radios in the archives that are all browsable. It's a free website. You don't need to subscribe to get in there. And it is a good very good collector resource. It has been by no means all inclusive. I'm amazed every day at the number of new radios that I get sent to me for the archives.
Well, you know, the thing that amazes me sometimes, and you know, I enjoy reading about radio and the radio industry and different manufacturers, and you know, there are guys who have compiled, you know, the Sears catalog so you could see all the silver tones, and folks have put together books on Philco and have done big spreads on this is all the Philco ads and ad books that they would use to sell radios to their, you know, all of this data. And then I'll hear of manufacturers or I'll see something, an old ad from somebody I've never heard of before, you know, Camden Radio. Who's Camden Radio? I mean, I knew RCA was in Camden, New Jersey, but are they separate? Are they different? And it always seems as if you're stumbling across something new and something different. And recently, I think I told you this the other day when I was chatting with you before, you know, we had you on the show, I had a National Union radio, and it was kind of unique, I thought. I had picked it up on the attic from an older fellow, and somebody said, you know, I've seen so much, but I've never seen something like that. Can I have that one? And
yep.
Not that it's a particularly great performer or from a technological point of view, anything super special. It's just, you know, I've seen, but that is really different, and I'd really like to have that one. So that's fine if it makes you happy, you know. So, but it's a huge amount of information, and you do a great job organizing it all.
Well, thank you.
And not only does Steve run the website, and certainly would hope you'd find something on there that you might like to bring home yourself, but you also collect radios. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how did you even get started in the hobby before the attic?
Oh gosh, I used to go to bed and breakfast years ago in northeast Alabama, and I drive through Fort Payne, Alabama, and there was an older couple there who had three little houses right next to each other on the street, And one of them lived in, and the other two they had stuff in that they sold. And I always stopped there to find something to buy whenever I went there to that part of the state. And one day I was there, I didn't have anything to buy, nothing that interests me at all. And I came across this Bendix AM/FM radio, the Bakelite case.
Mm-hmm.
And by way of background, I was trained in electronics in the U.S. Air Force back in the 70s, and knew a little bit about tubes and whatever, but not a whole lot. It kind of sifted out over the years. But I saw this radio, and I picked it up, and the old man was sitting on the front porch of this house in a rocking chair. And I'm talking out loud to myself, and I said, well, this old radio's kind of nice, you know, and I heard of me a lot. And it works, too, you know. And I looked at it some more, and I turned over the price tag, and I said, hey, well, it's $40 for this radio. I heard him say, yeah, I'll let you have it for $30. So I plugged it in and turned it on. It no better then. And it worked, and the dial lit up, and the tubes lit up, and you could smell that dust heating up from the holes in the back. And I remember that radar equipment I used to work on in the Air Force, and it all just came back in a big rush. And I said, well, I'm going to buy this radio. And I got it home, and I got curious, and I got to looking on the Internet and magazines or whatever, and I kind of got bit by it. And I think over the years, this was back in 1994, 1995, I think, and over the years I've sold, numbers-wise, I've sold off my entire collection twice after deciding I didn't like this particular kind of radio.
It's funny how you see that happen. You know, somebody will collect and collect and collect, and it seems like they're never going to part with anything. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, they say, well, you know, I mean, I've done about as much as I can with Zenith, so I'm going to sell off all the Zeniths, and I'm going to go do RCAs now. So,
you know, it's cheaper than adding a wing to the house.
Yeah, and especially the way, well, if you use the funds you get from selling the others to finance the other half of it,
right.
You know, it's activity, and it keeps people interested, and it keeps things a little bit fresh, but there's not a lot of collections that stay static, and there's always somebody who's... And again, you talk about on the article a little bit why you don't appraise old radios. You know, value is so relative. Somebody may have something that is extremely rare, that is electronically particularly good performer, so that would warrant some significant money for that particular set. But then you might just run into some guy who finds a set that was probably a $10 set when it was sold, nothing really special, maybe just a little five-tube set. That was the one that they used to have in Al's barbershop when I got my haircut in 1949.
Absolutely.
And that guy, I'll give you $500 for that thing, because I've been trying to find one of those for the last 25 years. And you see the collector's eyes roll back in his head.
Yep.
You know, he's saying, should I really take it, or should I say, hey, it's not really that special. I'll let you have it for 50, because I only bought it for 5 from some guy at a flea market, you know. But and that's another angle on the radio hobby, is that value is all driven by what the buyer or the prospective owner, you know, really perceives it to be. There are some rough guidelines that people put out as far as years of manufacture. You know, they say, well, if it's particularly
right.
old, or they didn't make a lot of them, or it was from a manufacturer that only lasted 2 or 3 years, those are really valuable ones. But that doesn't always hold water, especially when you have something somebody really wants to put their hands on.
It just depends on what you like. A lot of new collectors will ask, well, I'm trying to decide what kind of radio to collect. And I tried that. I tried collecting one kind of radio, and I decided I didn't like them. I sold them all. I tried collecting another kind of radio. Sold them all. Buy what you like. I like small Bakelite radios. I like mini-sized tombstones and cathedrals. I like chrome front radios. I like Catalan radios. I like square radios. I'm a sucker for push buttons. If you show me a radio with push buttons, 9 out of 10 I'm going to buy it, just because I like push buttons. That's how I am.
Yeah, everybody has their own, you know, their own little spin on things, and
yeah.
I have some larger sets, you know, more fancy, higher tube counts, but you run into issues with space. And as far as, you know, if you like to listen to whether it's baseball or news or whatever, you know, your local market has for AM usually these days, I've had some of my better luck with some of the smaller sort of unassuming looking sets with a good internal antenna.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, when somebody who knows what they're doing really gets in there and rejuvenates it. I have one in particular. I picked up stations that in my local area I never knew that they existed. You know, I couldn't find them. If I went to the internet and ran a list of all the radio stations, I would find them. But as far as tuning around on the dial, they're lower power. They fly under the radar screen. There are a lot of these locals, and some of them do some different programming. But on a big old set that has got about 7 or 8 tubes and a great internal antenna, you can get those 2,500, those 5,000-watt stations, and they sound fantastic. And you do find some of the more interesting content, too, on some of these little low-power stations as opposed to these, you know, big syndicated programs that they play the same on every city and on every
witness
radio station. Witness this broadcast from WRCA 1330 AM, a Beasley Broadcasting Company station. And I got to tell you,
when I
was checking out Beasley, because I said, well, you know, if it's a Beasley station we're going to do this show on, I should know something about Beasley. So I looked them up, and apparently they go back a few years. I guess to the 60s was when they really started buying up some radio stations. But there was a picture of, I guess he's the chairman of the board now, Mr. Beasley. He's older gentleman, and he's in his office, and he's standing next to this classic-looking Philco, an original Philco. You know, they have some reproduction radios that they show on the on their website as well. I said, well, there's a guy, obviously, this would not be lost on, you know, should he listen. So it's a group that I think has a little idea of what the history is, and they do a lot of different type of programming and support a lot of different type of programming. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I mean, how much of syndicated talk radio can one take and hope to remain sane, you know, for very long? So hopefully this is a little bit of a break for that for some people who are up listening late at night on AM. I'm not sure how big an audience that is anymore, but hopefully we'll get some positive feedback and be able to continue with this type of a broadcast. Steve, I just wanted to say thanks for taking some time out of your day, telling us a lot about the attic, and hope, you know, we can have you on again. We'll pick a couple of different topics, whether that's a manufacturer or a particular era, or maybe we talk about radio during World War II again. I don't know. That could be. I didn't even think of that as a prospective topic until that you talked about those folks in the Netherlands. And you know, you could also get into shortwave as well as another. There's a lot of different aspects to the hobby, and thanks for taking some time telling us about the attic and how it could help us learn a little bit more about a great hobby, hopefully a hobby that's around for a little while longer.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be on the radio and talk about it.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good
okay,
one.
You take care, Paul.